Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 2, delivered on August 24, 2017. The title of this lecture is The Financial System.
Today, The Financial System. Before I begin, let me make sure that you see the podcasts are now publishing real quick. I just want to make sure, at least they were as of this morning, and I'll check Apple to see if the spiders have picked it up yet. Again, your podcast will be at isu-prof.com, and we'll wait a while here while the page loads. For some reason, it loads slowly here, the center of it does. But the podcasts, usually I publish them within 24 to 48 hours of a lecture, and then the spiders at Apple pick them up fairly quickly after that. But like I said, yeah, your first lecture, this is lecture for your class, and this is for my big night class. And as you can see, the assignments, it's just pretty much where we are, and these are just announcements of what's going on in the course. Let me check over, see how Apple iTunes is doing.
Can't tell.
Nope, spiders haven't picked it up over there yet, looks like. So that'll come later. It takes a while for them to realize I'm back. I'm publishing again after the summer, but they'll come up there soon enough. And then, of course, you can click here and download it to your own computer and play it in there, or you can just play it right here. Wear headphones in case it gets loud, but yeah, that's it. I'm not going to play it because then you start laughing at my voice, which really irritates me. Okay, anyway, so there you are. That's it. It's running now. And this will give you a secondary source for filling in your notes. It's not a replacement for the class for a couple of reasons. One is you're supposed to be in class, but more importantly, I write on the board and you can't see that. That's why I'm going to experiment with a few lectures on vidcasting this time to see if I can actually get a high quality broadcast going and then see how that goes with one of the companies out in Los Angeles, see if they'll pick it up as a for cable TV. But that's not going to come for another semester after I've perfected this. Okay, now, again, today, introduction to finance. Before I start it, I'm going to see how much you heard from the last lecture. Madam, accounting and finance are very much related subjects. In fact, finance is just a kind of accounting, right? Yeah, accounting has very little to do with finance. We use some accounting information, but essentially finance is a subdiscipline of economics, not of accounting. As a matter of fact, you will hear me disrespect accountants in this class. They get mad. Some of you tell on me, and then they come in here and kick my ankles or something like that. But it's not accounting, and you're going to see that more and more clearly as the semester goes along. In fact, I'm going to show you some information today that gives you a sense of the difference, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the ways that accounting can mislead investors into believing what is not true. But again, I will make that distinction over and over again in the class that we do use accounting numbers, but we have to go well beyond that in our work. And I will say a few things. Are any of you accounting majors in here? Okay. Why do accountants walk in groups of three? Well, that's easy. One reads, one writes, and the other keeps an eye on the two intellectuals. Okay. Starting off rough. Okay. Can you, sir, can you tell me in a cost that is important in finance that does not show up in accounting numbers?
Yeah.
Can you think of one that I talked about? Where someone could give him a lifeline? You got one? Say it. Yeah, say it loudly. Yeah, don't be afraid. You know, I if you're wrong, I'm just going to say, you are so stupid. No, don't worry about it. Just say what you have to say. Yes, opportunity cost. A massive cost that drives our decision making is nowhere in accounting numbers. You just can't put it there. They have to follow rules. They have to have receipts. We have to look at what costs are hiding under the surface. Let me give you an example of how you can be misled. There were scandals that brewed up in the 1990s, and I was in that world in the time, and there were a lot of shenanigans going on, and they kept going on after that. One of them was a company called WorldCom. WorldCom was considered one of the great companies of that time period, back in the 90s, in the 90s, and even into the 2000s. Their profits were just enormous, huge revenues, and their expenses were well under control. So when you get the revenues minus the expenses, you got these great accounting profits at the bottom line. Well, it turned out that the way WorldCom was pulling this stunt was actually quite simple. Expenses, big cash outflows. What they were doing was they were recognizing those as capitalized expenses, which means they showed up on the balance sheet as assets. And then, with respect to the income statement, they weren't being showing up there to deduct from revenues. So you had revenues minus inappropriately reported low expenses, made for big profits, the bottom line. And then at the same time, those expenses were being capitalized as assets on the balance sheet. So you had the balance sheet looking huge. And so eventually what happened was the company just collapsed. It wasn't there anymore. I mean, because they didn't have money. Cash flow is all that matters to survival. It's not profit, it's cash flow. So WorldCom went tap city. The investors went all kinds of sad. And then the federal government got all righteous about it and passed some laws to say bad people don't do this. That was the origin of some of the regulations in the early 21st century, Sarbanes-Oxley, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Another one, famous one, was Enron. Enron was named by Fortune magazine as, I think they said it was the best company in the world or something like that. They just said it's an incredible company, amazing company. Well, Enron, based down in Texas, where I was doing a lot of consulting work in the time, was considered a great company. Here's what Enron's trick was. Well, okay, let me tell you one of their other tricks. Now, one of my fellow students at Ohio State University was an energy trader for Enron, and he was in the thick of doing this trick. Now, what Enron would do, they were an energy company. They would sell electricity into California, and then they would route it back out and sell it into Nevada. And maybe they'd even route it again and sell it somewhere else. So California was having these rolling brownouts and blackouts for years, and everyone was pointing the fingers at everyone else and talking about, it's all because we consume too much, we got to be energy savers, and it's your fault, consumers, for being such energy hogs, and it's your fault, politicians, for not having more electrical capacity in the grid. No, it wasn't their fault. It was Enron playing games, swapping out the electricity. It was just sending it in, selling it there, and then pulling it back out, routing it back out, and selling it other places. That was one of their tricks. They were just, they had an evil, I don't like this word ethics. It's so fancy and so pop. I'm supposed to teach you ethics. Trust me, I'll tell you about it. But this was beyond some ethical thing. This was just plain wrong what they were doing. They were hurting millions of people and causing all kinds of thinking that was not directed at the right problem. But anyway, that was another thing. Now, here is the thing about the financial statements of Enron. The top, here's Enron. Now, its top chief executive officers, what they were doing was they were creating offshore all of these shell companies, offshore shells. And this is an oversimplification of it to a certain extent, but this captures the essence of what they were doing. What they would do is they would take Enron assets and they would sell them at inflated prices to the shells on paper. Well, that part they kind of reported. So these shells had this value in them from the money that Enron was paying them. But then there was a backdoor agreement that later those shells would sell the assets back into Enron at ridiculously inflated prices. There was nothing in Enron's disclosures that described this forward agreement to buy back these assets at ridiculously higher prices than they sold them at. But as they did that, of course, they would sell these assets back in to the company, and that would create more money in these shells, which were owned by Enron executives. As time went on, these executives were just essentially just multi-millionaires with their holdings offshore that were not reported because they were foreign entities, so there was no reporting requirement. And Enron was being bled dry of cash flow. Its profits still looked good. I mean, when you buy something that's worth $1 million for $10 million, you put that on your financial statements and your balance sheet on your assets. So Enron looked like it was growing and growing and growing at this massive rate, but it was running out of money, cash. And finally, they were so desperate for cash, the company was, that they started issuing what we call commercial paper, which is very trustworthy short-term borrowings by companies to wealthy investors. Wealthy investors in this didn't have any idea that there was any problem. Oh, yeah, Enron's one of the greatest companies in the world. Sure, we'll issue them 30-day commercial paper. That was just money that the company had to get to pay the light bills. Then they started selling off huge assets rapidly to other companies in Texas, like pipelines. They sold one pipeline to another company for like $2 billion, I think it was. And of course, there was a little bit of that that went out here to these guys. And that was just a few weeks before the company finally just collapsed. It just dropped in on itself. It just fell down, died right there in the dust of Texas desert heat. That's bad enough as it is. The stockholders, the stock just dropped to virtually nothing, almost overnight. Worse than that was the Enron employees. Their pension plan was a stock pension plan that invested all of its money for the pensions, taking it out of the people's payroll, invested in Enron stock. So when Enron went tap city, all of these tens of thousands of everyday people lost their retirement. One of them was a friend of mine, and he and his wife had worked for Enron for he'd worked for about 30 years. She'd worked there about 20. He killed himself. He just blew his brains out. That's the pension. That was just a disaster right there in our faces. A company that looked healthy on paper, on the accounting statements, was actually just a rotten. It was a core that had rotted to nothing. These kinds of scandals actually began to create, how should I put it, a sense that there has to be more law, more regulation in place to deal with this. The regulations were, one of them was, and when I write things on the board, when I say this kind of stuff, I hold you to knowing what I'm talking about here. This was Sarbanes-Oxley was a big one. Sarbanes-Oxley. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act. SOX, we call it. S-O-X. First thing was the one problem that was always there, and in my time, I actually exploited this problem too. There was an incestuous relationship between the outside auditing firms, those big firms in New York, LA, Chicago, and the companies they were auditing. There was a friendly old boy thing. You're the outside auditor. I'm the CFO of Big Corp International. You know, we know each other. We're buddies. You come in there, and we got some financial statements, and you look at them. Yeah, there's a few problems here. Well, you know how we do that. Oh, yeah. By the way, I've got a steak dinner tonight for you and your family and all this kind of stuff. It was everywhere in the industry, and I played this myself. I would write financial statements, and these small accounting firms, I knew the people there. Some of them had been my students. Some of them had been my fellow students at Ohio State. I'd say, I got some financial statements. Can you sign off on them? And I knew that in some cases, these guys were desperate for money. I'd have the company cut them a check for $10,000. They wouldn't even look at those financial statements, okay? Where the problem came was when I had to do it right. I learned very quickly that when I wanted to get these companies listed on stock exchanges, the compliance people at the NASD would look over those and pull them apart and find every trick and nonsense thing that I was doing. So in the end, there was a self-disciplining, at least for me, with the markets that I worked with. But anyway, Sarbanes-Oxley said, you've got to get this incestuous relationship out of there. There's got to be a wall between those firms out there that audit your financial statements and you guys in here that are the ones who are being audited. That ended somewhat that. There was also another part to this where essentially, what they did was they said, all right, you executive officers here in this company, you're saying you weren't involved. How could you possibly know that there was all of this chicanery going on in the financial statements? Okay, well, that's nice. Now, from now on, you executive officers and you members of the board of directors who just sit there collecting a nice little check for doing nothing, you sign all of those disclosure documents, financial statements, the 10-Ks, 10-Qs, you sign them. So that means that you are certifying that you do know what's going on. And if something goes wrong, you are held liable, just like the accounting firm. You can go to prison, too, if there's something wrong. That was quite a thing for these officers. They began to get a little bit more, let's pay attention to what's going on. And it also got them to start the process, which is still going on, of knocking it off with just thinking about profit in an accounting sense. They had to start contemplating, what are the consequences if we have these giant profits and then we go belly up? I guess we kind of have to think about things other than just stating that we got a great profit. Okay. Now, there was a third aspect to this too. And here there's a little bit of political thing I have to tell you about. Keep in mind, I'm not going to tell you right or wrong in political parties and people, but I will tell you an interesting thing that happened. A part of Sarbanes-Oxley increased the protection for whistleblowers in corporations. So that if you were in a company and you saw bad things going on, you could go to the feds. They would protect you. They would also give you incentives in terms of rewards as a percentage of what you had shown the company was doing wrong. That helped get whistleblowers to lose some of their fear. Now, understand that fear is still a part of it. Now, let me get into that. This was happening in the first decade, early years of the 21st century. Yeah, back when you were really young, the Sarbanes-Oxley. Interestingly enough, during that time, Whistleblowers in companies were still getting a lot of retaliation. There was a lot of fear and loathing. But interestingly enough, whistleblowers in the government were coming out with nonsense that was going on in the government, accounting, and also, you know, overbilling projects and disclosing bad things our government was doing all over the place. Now, this was during the George W. Bush administration. There was never a prosecution of a government whistleblower during that period. However, corporate whistleblowers were still getting nailed to the wall, although some were getting through and actually doing okay. There was an increase in whistleblowing, and there was also an increase in the sense in companies that I was working with that if we don't do it right, we might have someone tell on us in the company. Okay. So in other words, there was some protection of whistleblowers going on in the private sector, and there was a lot of protection going on of whistleblowers in the public sector. Move us to the Obama years. Now, we refer to presidents like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama as neoliberals. They have a liberal bend in their social policy, but they are pro-business in their business policy. So we get into the Obama years, and interestingly enough, a lot of whistleblowers who came forward in the private sector were just destroyed by their employers. I will have you read an article about that tells a story of some of what happened to whistleblowers in the period from about 2008 to 2012. They were just being creamed all over the place by their employers for squealing. In the public sector, during the Bush years, there had not been one prosecution of a government whistleblower. In the Obama years, there were many prosecutions and many whistleblowers went to prison for disclosing state secrets. So that gives you an interesting kind of odd perspective that doesn't quite align with other things you know about those two administrations. You'll hear me say good things about different presidents, and you'll also hear me tell you the unfortunate parts of some of those presidents' policies too. But know this, being a whistleblower is dangerous. There is retaliation. They make examples of people who squeal. And some of the famous ones, you're going to read about how bad it gets for someone who says companies are doing dirty stuff, especially when those companies have the power to make congressmen crawl to them, which is very common, especially with the big banks. Okay, that was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which interestingly enough was one of the reasons I got, well, it was a reason I got out of consulting was because they cleared the field of the low players like me. They just drove us out of the business with capital requirements and reporting requirements. They got us out of there real quick, the little guys like me. Okay, so now there's one more that I'll bring up here before I go on. Sarbanes-Oxley was a meat axe, just wham. Like most early legislation that addresses a problem, it just went overboard. It was just broad. The language was unclear. It was complex beyond your wildest dreams. Seriously, I call Sarbanes-Oxley the Accountant and Lawyer Employment Guarantee Act because you had to be a really good accountant, a really high and fancy lawyer to be able to cut through all of Sarbanes-Oxley. I couldn't do any of that. I couldn't live in that world. Okay, what happened was some years later, a refinement of Sarbanes-Oxley was passed by Congress and signed by the president. Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank is actually, if you listen to bankers talk about Dodd-Frank, or Frank Dodd, some of them call it, they will talk about it like it is the evilest thing in the universe. They just scream bloody murder about how bad, how harsh, how sometimes capricious and ridiculous the requirements are. But at its core, Dodd-Frank was actually a refinement of Sarbanes-Oxley. It put companies under $75 million into exemption from Sarbanes-Oxley on a lot of the owner's requirements. In other words, small firms, low capitalization firms were not going to be put to as much of a test as the big firms. Go. Yes. And we had a couple of the heavies of the banking industry here. They were alum of ISU. They were big dogs. And I think it was for some kind of a lifetime achievement award or something like that. And they met with the faculty of finance. And they really refined people. They know so much about the world of finance and world of banking. It was almost intimidating for everyone but me. I don't care. But they just talked and talked about Dodd-Frank. And some of the things they said, I didn't even know. And it was just like jaw-dropping. They do that? What? It's like sometimes, I think one of them said, if we screw up something in Frank Dodd, there's something that we can do that we don't even mean to do it. They'll make us so that we can't pay a dividend to our shareholders for a while. It's almost like they punish the shareholders for a mistake that the executives made, then the shareholders scream and bitch and all that kind of stuff. But so at its heart, it took small companies out of Sarbanes-Oxley's onerous burden of reporting and regulatory requirements. But for the most part, a lot of people are griping about Frank Dodd on the grounds that its requirements are ridiculous. Interestingly enough, though, there's a larger story here. The global community of advanced nations, the G8 as we call it, there's been a whole lot of international standards of reform that have been going on since the 1990s. There have been different rounds of talks, and this treaty has been getting refined over, I think we're in the third round of the treaty. And a treaty under our Constitution is the law of the land. So when Frank Dodd says, you do this, it might be something that we have to do under treaty anyway with respect to G8, the big eight countries of the global environment. So it's kind of complicated because there's this outside world there talking to us, telling us, you get on board with all of these things we want to do. And it's a dynamic tension because we're enemies and adversaries in some realms, China, Russia, for example. But in this arena, we try to work together towards a more stable financial system. Is it stable? Oh, hell no. Anyway, I'm going to do something here, go through, and I talked a little about this, but I want to make sure that you know this part, the basic structure. I used to teach Business 100, and I taught it there. I don't know if they're still showing this to me or not, to you or not. But now it's more important that you understand how companies can be structured. The single largest class of companies by number, not by value, but by pure numbers, are the sole proprietorships in the world. This is a one-person show. Almost every one of you has been a sole proprietor. Every one of you in here has been one of these companies. Now, it is personal liability. You are the company. It dies when you die. And you are all at risk. In other words, if that company does something, that means you have done it personally. So you run a lawn mowing company. And so you're driving along some rich lady's lawn and you run over her poodle. And you give it a show dog trim. She's going to take whatever she can get out of your pockets, out of your bank account, then she's going to take your mower, your ugly old truck, And she's probably going to take your clothes, too. She'd take your music, but fortunately for you, you listened to dubstep and no one wanted it. You walk dogs in the summer. You babysit. You are a male gigolo. Or not. Okay, you see, you understand that anyone, write a check to me. In fact, you can even go to the state. Now understand that companies are a state phenomenon. Companies are not a federal thing. Companies, of all companies, register in a state. Now, you don't technically have to register a sole proprietorship. You still have to report on your income taxes. There's a Schedule C where you report your income for the company, your business, and then you move that income to your 1040. Then there's another form that you have to report your profit from the company and calculate your Social Security tax, and you add that line to your tax that you owe the government at the bottom of your 1040. So there's a requirement there, and a lot of companies don't do this. In matter of fact, it is well known that the vast majority of companies don't report their income from sole proprietorships. I'm sure every one of you has reported every dollar that you have made on the side. So we're talking about people other than you. Am I right? Okay, good. Now, in fact, it's interesting that the IRS has struggled to crack down on this for a long, long time. As I told you, I am an artist, and I sell my work at art festivals all over the country with all the other gypsies, tramps, and thieves. And you see it more now than you used to. These people walking around, they're just like everyone else. Just come in, they start chatting with you, and they start asking, well, you know, I'm an artist too. What kind of business is this? How much money do you make? I know darn well those are agents. They're all over these flea markets and art shows and craft shows trying to find out who is who and who's making money and reporting it and who is not. It's going on more commonly now than it used to, but I usually can figure out who they are a mile away, but sometimes I've thought afterwards, that conversation didn't go quite right for me. And I have a feeling that I was talking to someone who was trying to find out if I was making money and then check back and see if I was reporting it. So there you go. In other countries, it is to the point where in some countries, there's so much underground activity that is not being reported in taxes that these countries literally are in severe trouble financially because there's so much business activity that doesn't get reported. For example, Greece is legendary for the black markets and the gray markets. Even here in the United States, if you decide that you're going to start running a meth lab, are you going to report that income to the IRS?
No.
Of course you're not. Yes, here's Form C. What's your business? Meth labs are us. Yeah, sure you are. Yes. Things like that are very common in this country. One thing that was really shocking that blew us away, these two economics, they were young economists, they were looking for something that they could publish an interesting paper on. So they actually went underground. I think they went underground. Maybe they did it straight up, but I think they went underground. And they went into one large corporation, one building in New York City, and they studied the amount of play on sports gambling just in that one building. And then they extrapolated that to a U.S. scale. All these companies, each one of them is doing this, and they know that it's very common. The number was staggering. It was in the taxes that were not being paid were in the high tens of billions of dollars. Purely off illegal, shadow, gray market, black market gambling. Just off that. One, go.
Are you talking about like office pools,
the fantasy football that goes into the betting? Yeah, I mean, it, and there was betting going on everything. I mean, and it's complex. It is mind-boggling. I mean, you can. It's not just, you know, who wins. It's point spreads. It's on players and whether they go above or below their average in a game on yards gained or RBIs or whatever. They go down to the level of even games. There was a report that they were even betting in Canada on black market gambling on curling. Do you know what curling is? It's the most boring sport on earth. Unless you do the part, have you seen the one where they put the cats on the stones and the cats go down? That's cool. The cat's just, oh yeah, this is cool, I'm floating. Look, okay, so anyway, pay your taxes on it, for God's sake. Okay, and sole proprietorship. But the key is that it is a one-person show, you are all at risk, and when you die, this entity dies. Now, you can apply to the state for a DBA, a doing business as. You don't have to, but you can actually get a fictitious name, or some states call it an assumed name. I have run a lot of my businesses under DBAs. You file a form with the county clerk. The county clerk says, here's your receipt. You go to a business publication, publish it, your claim for 3 weeks on this name, and then they'll send you a letter back saying that no one challenged it. Then you bring it back to the clerk of the county, and they give you a big placard, and that thing is your name permanently. You own it. And I've done this on a number of occasions. One that I have had for years, and you might see it come up on some of my work, Dark Wraith Publishing. It's a DBA. It's just purely a DBA, but it's mine and I control it. And when I die, my control over it will go away unless I sell it. Another one that I did, and this is a trick that you'll see sometimes, is a DBA. I created a company back when I wasn't sure whether it would survive or not called Emergent Light Studio. And that was a doing business as. I got the name, assumed name, qualified here in Illinois, and then a few years later, I incorporated because I was doing okay. I figured I would survive if barely, and so I sold the DBA to the corporation so the corporation could claim the name Emergent Light Studio, Inc. So you can do that. Another thing DBAs are used for is to hide things that you do, or to redirect people so that they don't think that it's your primary corporation. Good hotel chains, they will sometimes use DBAs for their crappy places that I stay at, okay? Some of these really rip-off quickie loan places, you look back behind it and that's a DBA of some reputable place. That's common too, hiding what you're doing. So in other words, you sir, are a reputable businessman. You run a company that sells cuddle kitties to babies and fluffy stuffed toys to young adults. Okay, you use a DBA that they would never think for your work as a male gigolo. Okay, he's protected. No one would know that world champions, your escort service, is actually related to Cuddle Kitties Are Us. No one would know. A DBA protects your reputation for a couple of reasons, either because it's questionable what you're doing, or you don't want your brand on one to infect your brand on another. So, for example, you might have some risky stuff that you're doing, business risk. You want to keep that so that investors don't associate that with your more reliable, responsible, creditworthy activities in another company. That can be done with DBAs. And also, as I did, when you don't know whether a company is going to survive, you don't want to go through the hell of doing the incorporation and all that kind of stuff. So you started as a DBA to see if it's even worth the startup. Then you would later switch it and sell the name into the corporation that you were forming. A lot of different ways. Okay, now, the partnership. This is one person over here. This is more than one. Now, the one thing that is important here is that a partnership can be informal, but you still have to file a statement of the partnership with the state for it to be legit. It can still operate, but it's not legit if you don't file that partnership agreement. This states who's who in the thing. But they are all at risk jointly and severally. All at risk. Everyone in there is going to be at risk. So in other words, if the two of you have a corporation, have a partnership, if you screw up, you have screwed up. You can't say, oh, it was her. It's her liability. No, it's yours together. That's why in the world that you'll go into, if you step into a company that's a partnership, they are going to put you through hell for a couple of years before they decide that you're worth pulling in as a real partner. It happens in accounting, in law, in brokerage firms. You saw, if any of you saw the movie Pursuit of Happiness, that was they were bucking for one partnership in that brokerage firm. And they were going through hell to get there. And only the best of the best were going to survive because all the other partners, bringing you in means that I have now put my soul in your hands. And when one of the partners dies, the partnership dies. Now, if you're smart, you create partnerships in such a way that they roll over and fold into a partnership of the same name upon the abandonment. So you can see a partnership that's been around for more than a century, but what's been happening is as partners died, it folded into a partnership of the same name without that one name. Go.
But if it's a couple, like a spouse couple, then it's still a sole
proprietorship, right? Oh, that's very good, because a marriage creates a person. The two of you together exist as a single entity under the law. So that it's interesting. I've never even brought that one up. Anything that would be someone who is you in a marriage agreement is one of those. You are jointly and severally liable for what happens, even to the extent of some criminal, but most definitely in civil. And the same is true with children, too. You bring a child in to your organization until that child is of age of majority in that state. That child is just you. This creates a lot of tension in households because essentially the parent is at jeopardy for anything that child does. It is fully and totally liable under common law. There is no, well, he's 17 and he's his own person. That's one of the reasons we have... There's so many tries at reform of those kinds of laws, the laws of majority, the laws of consent, because we do know that there is such a thing as consent. There is such a thing as mind of your own at a younger age, but at the same time, we also know that we can't really trust them to have good judgment, and I'm not sure any of them have good judgment even into their 30s and 40s, but there you go. The partnership is... No, just know that if you get into a partnership work, they're going to haze you. They're going to beat you up. They're going to make your life miserable because once they pull you in, you're part of the program. And they can't really get rid of you unless they kill you or they have a meeting of the partners and you are kicked out, which means that they have to redo the partnership again. So they're going to be very cautious, and that's the same for you. Don't just go into a partnership because you were buds in college. Don't go into it because you shared a bong, okay? Nothing like that. Don't do that. You have to have that trustworthiness, that reliability that is part of the game. Now, there's one over here on the side that's another kind of company, the LLC. They've gotten a fad, a pop fad in the U.S. Technically, they should be one way, but they're being used another way these days. And they're just very tricky to play with. And they were I think Utah was the first state in the U.S. that allowed LLCs. They've been common overseas for centuries, I think, in some places. GmbHs in Germany are actually LLCs. That's an LLC. If you see GmbH on a name in or a limited, could be an LLC in some countries. So I'm not going to mention those, but I do want to get to the pinnacle of capitalism, the corporation. The corporation is uniquely defined relative to these others. The truth of the matter is, a corporation is a legal entity of its own. It is a legal entity. It exists as separate from its owners under law. And as I told you before, all companies are state entities. They're not federal entities. I actually did a count over the summer. I'd thrown out numbers in the past. For clients, I have created about 24 companies that I could count of different kinds for different purposes. For my own purposes or for purposes with others in business with me, I thought I'd done more. I've done 8. The last one that is now, the last one that hasn't died is the one that is probably the most successful of all of them, the one that survived, the survivor. The thing is that how you make a corporation, just the outline, and I actually did one when I was teaching Business 100, and I was about to make Emergent Light Studio from a sole proprietorship into a corporation. I did it with my students one night in class. It was really cool because they got to actually see the birth of an entity. You create these articles of incorporation. They say how much stock exists, not how much is outstanding, but how much you can, over the life of the corporation, sell. You name the corporation. You give its business address. You say a few things about what the company does. You also say who the agent for service of process is. In other words, you name an address of some person who is going to get any legal documents from the state or feds. You also say that upon the filing of these articles of incorporation, the rights of the originators of the entity vanish and are transferred to the officers and directors. You create bylaws, a constitution, mission statement, all that. You file them with the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation. Now, if they are in order, the Secretary of State sends back the qualification. The government at all levels never, ever approves anything that is filed. We say that they qualify it. So if you've done the articles of incorporation properly, they qualify the company. It has been born. Those stamped articles of incorporation are the birth certificate of a legal entity. It is born. And every time I used to have clients, well, I want to make a corporation, I make sure that they understand the gravity of what they are doing. This is important. This isn't a joke. Now, if the state in which you file your articles of incorporation, you are domiciled in that state. So oftentimes I would file articles of incorporation in the state of Delaware because they have a very mature business law, a court system. But the state in which you operate, if it's, let's say I filed articles of incorporation in Delaware, I am a foreign entity in all other states. So in other words, I have my company is actually domiciled in the state of Illinois. When I go down to Missouri or I go out to LA or to New York or down to Florida to do art shows, I am a foreign corporation. I'm not. My corporation is foreign in those states. It's that serious, and you have to keep that in mind when you do things. Okay. You remember in accounting the fundamental equation, assets equal liabilities plus owners of equity? That's real. You see, the liabilities of the corporation belong to the corporation. So when you mowed that dog over, if you were a corporation, the aggrieved could go no further than the assets of the corporation. They can't touch you. They cannot touch you. Okay? That is very important for protecting and giving incentive to owners to take risk. It also has the downside, and it's also an opportunity for you. I want you to imagine, madam, you are famous. You've been on TV. You're considered the business guru of the 20th century. You're a genius. Everybody knows you. You've even had your own show. You formed corporations. You formed a corporation. You got a whole bunch of investors into that. You paid yourself an incredibly high salary. You made a lot of money. And then, of course, when it turned out that it was you're not very good at what you do, the company went bankrupt. You guys lost everything, and you just move on to your next deal. You understand? You can form corporation after corporation, and as long as you keep the books right, you can pay yourself a massive salary over and over and over again. And when it turns out that things go south, you just go bankrupt. Your corporation does. You come out smelling like a rose. You get to keep all the stuff that you bought. You get to keep all the money you put in the bank. You get to keep your reputation. And you can go on. You understand how it works? That's how you can become very wealthy. And that's how a lot of the wealthy people who are supposedly great geniuses of business play it. I even ran into some of them in my work, and I just didn't quite get it. Don't you want this company to do well? Not really. They said they did, but the whole point of the game was this was just one show in a running carnival. I ran into people like that. So, and this is the power of the corporation. It allows companies to take risks, but the people who do the play aren't at risk. Go.
So I worked for a very large privately owned company over the summer. If it's privately owned, can it still be a corporation?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it's only a public corporation if they do these filings. I'll talk about all this with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Otherwise, it's a private company. And one of the interesting things is that public companies have to be transparent, all of their information. We really don't know a whole lot about this vast ocean of private companies because they don't have to disclose anything. Well, a few things, but we can't even see their taxes. As long as they stay private, and as long as their owners are protected by shield laws, privacy laws, We know hardly anything about them whatsoever. So it's only estimates that we can make of what we do is we have private companies that allow us to analyze them, structure them. And so we sort of use those as our extrapolators for all these ones out there. We know how many there are, but we don't know much about them. But by analyzing the sample, which might be biased because either the people are willing to let us see them, we have some ideas of what they are doing out there. But oh yeah, corporations don't have to be public. Now, here's the thing with a corporation. The owners are separated. They can't get involved, but they do to a certain extent. But a corporation has to do what is right for its shareholders. Know this, there is one and only one goal of a corporation. That is to maximize the wealth of its shareholders. Period. There is no objective for stakeholders. Well, we got to protect Mother Earth. Oh, we'll say that. We lie. It makes people feel good. You have one and only one goal in a corporation. That is to maximize the wealth of the owners, the shareholders, the stockholders. You can talk all you want about the stakeholders, the workers, the environment, the community. That is fluff. It is the shareholders who can fire your butt at the end of the day as an executive officer. And unfortunately, that's not even playing right now. We'll talk about that next week in ethics. But therein lies the problem. You see, the shareholders can make... Go ahead. They can feel whatever they want. They can. Just as humans can. There's no question. But at the end of the day, who is going to fire them if they don't make your stock go up in price? If you have a corporation, we give half of our profits to Mother Earth. You're a stockholder. That means that your stock price is not going to go up as fast. You didn't get a dividend. Oh, we gave that dividend to this charitable organization over here. You see, what we do with this kind of work is it's promo, it's PR. It is for the benefit. Interestingly enough, I took my students up to one of the baseball teams in Chicago. Won't mention which one. It was interesting because we talked to the people in their charitable organizations. They provide the funds for thousands of kids across Chicagoland to play Little League Baseball in the summer. It's called charity. It's a lot of money. But is that really charity? You know what they're doing with all those kids? They're watching them to see who the talent is. A couple of ball players a year that have a damn fine arm or can run those bases fast, they've got themselves a contract. They'll take care of that kid and his family until he's ready to sign and get on the ball field. Everything we do has to be optics. Optics, in other words, the perception of the public and the regulators for what we have. Now, understand, again, though, you see, when a corporation gets to its bottom line, there are two things that it can do with profit. The company can pay dividends to its shareholders, or it can plow the money back into the company to increase the value of the stock. Now, if I give my shareholders big dividends, that's money that I can't reinvest in the company. If I reinvest all of my money in the company, my shareholders are going to say, well, when am I going to make something? When is the stock price going to go up? I need a check today. I have been in front of corporations as a consultant when the corporate executive officer said, you go out and talk to them. They're mad because we haven't paid them a dividend. Literally, in some cases, just furious at the annual shareholders meeting. I had this one woman, she just would not quit. We have never seen a dividend from you. We have had this investment for 5 years and no dividend, and the stock price is going up a little bit, but why don't you give us a dividend? And she just kept going on and on. And I had to be professional with her. I said, look, bitch. Sorry. I explained to her that you got a choice. I can give you money today, and then there's no chance that our corporation will get on its feet and develop its product. But I didn't understand what she was doing. I understood the point she was making. There's a balance that you have to play between the dividends and the cash flow. Typically, young corporations will not pay dividends. That's because they are taking all their money because if they give you a dividend, if I give you a dividend, madam, the reason I'm doing it is because I'm saying I don't know what to do with this money in the company. That's a sign of weakness. But if I don't give you any dividend at all after 20 years, that's also a sign of weakness too. There's a point where dividends are like a signal. It's not so much that I give you a dividend because I love you or I don't have anything to do with that money. What I'm doing instead with dividends is oftentimes I'm showing that I can do this. I can provide. It's like the rich relative who gives you money. Not because he really likes you, he's a kind of creepy, a weird guy, but at the same time, he wants to signal to you, I am wealthy. I've been taken out to dinners at fabulous places by corporate executives, they just wanted to show off. Yeah?
Can dividends also be as a play to entice people to invest in your company?
Why would I invest in a company that doesn't have anything to do with that money except give it away? I would probably, yeah, to a certain extent, but you understand that it's not so much the level of the dividend, it is the consistency. I've had companies say, well, let's pay our first dividend. I tell them, if you start paying that dividend, you're going to be in the program. Because if you ever stop paying it, they're going to wonder why. And also, you have to grow that dividend because the growth of the dividend matters to the valuation of the stock. So it's a balancing act. In some cases, though, many cases, it is a signal of the health of the corporation, which is to some extent what you're talking about there. Exactly, actually, it's exactly what you're talking about. And so you see this all through the business world. What doesn't make sense on a financial level makes sense on a signaling engineering level. Because what you're doing is you're seeing signals being sent. There was this one year I was invited to the Christmas party. I had consulted for a big, powerful brokerage, insurance broker. In other words, the kind that deals with huge corporations. And I was at the dinner, and it was a fabulous affair. It was just showing off. These little lamb chops, thousands and thousands of rows of little lamb chops. And I kept thinking, I can't eat these. There was a lamb there. And all this food. And then the president of the company comes up, the corporation. And he just stands there at the front with a glass of wine, talking about how incredible the year was, just bragging. And at the end, he's saying his final lines, and he pulls out a Cuban cigar, and he takes it, and he pulls a $100 bill out, and he lights it. I thought, you're going there. And he lit that $100 bill, and then he lit his cigar and said, oh, yes, it was a very good year. And he throws the $100 bill into an ashtray. Well, my ass is over there. Don't. But I thought, I actually saw someone light a cigar with a $100 bill. It was the first time I've seen it twice. I saw it twice after that. And why they do that, there is something so wrong about that. But look, the point here is that dividends are more of a signal than they are anything else. But know that once a company starts paying a dividend, it's going to be in the program. Now, as far as this is the layout of corporate structures. There's some other information in the book. It's pretty easy to digest. But at the core of this lecture, I want you to understand that when you are analyzing business entities, you are in this world right here. Know this, that stock exchanges are where you buy and sell stocks of corporations. That is in the secondary market. You are not buying stock from a corporation. If you buy Facebook stock, you're not buying Facebook stock from Facebook. It was already bought in a public offering. And you are never going to be in a position where you will buy initial stock. You will not buy stock in the primary market. That is the rarefied world of the investment banks that actually buy the whole block from the company issuing. And then they sell it to their clients. And when they flip it, probably a couple of times, that's when you're going to get your hands on it. It's in the secondary market is where you will buy and sell stock. Stock represents ownership. Again, stock represents ownership. Bonds and other things, put down notes and bills. Bonds, notes, and bills represent debt. Know this. If you sell stock, about the worst that can happen with your investors is what happened to me. You have them yell at you because they're not getting a dividend. You have them mad at you because the stock price isn't going up. They can't do any more because they're the owners. What are you going to do? Kill my corporation? You're killing yourself. The bondholders, if you don't pay them, they will end you. They will end it. The bondholders, as I say famously, and I get in trouble every semester, the stockholders, they can yell at you. The bondholders can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. They can ruin you. They can destroy you. Your corporation. Not you personally, but they can wreck the corporation. Otherwise, a corporation is immortal. It has no finite life. Sir, you're going to die someday. Did you know that? No. Hear me out. You're going to die. It's going to probably hurt like hell. You're going to scream and fuss, and finally you'll die and shut up. Inevitable. It could be in 100 years. Or you could walk outside and walk across the Amtrak track. Ding, 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 ding. Get the spatula. A corporation does not have a finite life, theoretically. It can be absorbed, bought, taken, and destroyed in bankruptcy. It can be ended, but it cannot end on its own. It is immortal. This is the danger. For many years, a lot of people are very upset because there was a case at the Supreme Court called Citizens United, where the Supreme Court extended free speech to corporations. The problem is that was a slope that's been on for many years, giving corporations more rights under the Constitution. The Supreme Court justices don't understand. They say, well, it's a person under the law, it's a living entity, so of course the Constitution protects it. Not understanding the fundamental difference between a human and a corporation. We are mortal. Corporations are not. The Constitution, if you are to say that it recognizes corporations as persons just like people, you're saying that it recognizes something that is a fundamentally different thing. It is an immortal thing. That, I'm not sure, was the intent of the framers of the Constitution, but that's where we are now. Corporations are recognized as full participants in many arenas of constitutional law. But remember, you can't kill the corporation unless it actually can't pay its bills. If you're a stockholder, I don't care, really, at the end of the day. Unless you can get a hostile takeover started on me, I'm going to ignore your complaining. You're an owner. But if you're a debt holder and I don't pay my interest payment for a quarter, you can shut me down. You can end me as a corporation. Don't get old. Just finish yourself before you get to this age. Okay, that's all I have for you today. Go home.